Vincent.
Good morning, everybody. So we will discuss Agenda Paper 12, which discusses the proposed amendment to IS 16, property, plant and equipment, on proceeds before intended use. As a reminder, the proposed amendment to IS 16 would prohibit deducting from the cost of an item of PP&E any proceeds from selling item produced while bringing that asset to the location and condition necessary for it to be capable of operating in the manner intended by management. Instead, an entity would recognize the sales proceeds together with the cost of producing those items in profit or loss in accordance with applicable standards. In November 2018, the Board considered the feedback on the exposure draft and decided to proceed with finalizing the amendments. In particular, the Board confirmed the proposal to require the recognition of the sales proceeds and related production costs in profit or loss. However, the Board directed the staff to consider possible modification to the proposed amendments to address two matters raised by stakeholders. The first matter relates to the identification of production cost, and the second matter relates to the presentation and disclosure requirements. Paragraph 14 to 21 discuss the identification of production cost. We recommend that the Board amend IS 16 to require an entity to identify and measure the cost of producing items before an item of PP&E is available for use, applying the measurement requirement in IS2 inventories. Paragraph 22 to 44 discuss presentation and disclosure requirements. We recommend that the Board develop such requirements only when an entity assesses that the sales of items are not part of its ordinary activities, that is, when the entity does not apply IFRS 15 and IS2 to the sales proceeds and production costs, respectively. I will now direct your attention to question 1 on page 13 of the paper. In this question, we ask whether the Board agrees with our recommendation on the presentation and disclosure requirements and on the measurement of production costs. In other words, we ask whether you agree with our recommendation set out in paragraphs 21, 43, and 44 of the paper.
Thanks, Vincent. I do agree with the approach that staff have taken, thinking about operating and non-operating. I've got three things that I'd like to raise. The first thing relates to paragraph 10. So I'll take them, my three things, I'll take them in the order as they appear in the paper. So when I was looking at what you've got in 10B, item 1, item 2, what you're planning to do is amend 16 and require specific disclosures. I just wondered how that fits with what we're doing in primary financial statements, because I know that I believe we need to proceed with this, and this reflects some considerable work that we've been doing for some time. But we've also got same ongoing work, and I wouldn't want to hear feedback that said, oh, why did you have to mandate these particular disclosures at this point, when surely they would have been picked up through your disaggregation principle in primary financial statements? So I think that we just need to consider that that's a kind of thing that could be raised. I'm not saying to not go ahead as proposed by staff. I would support going ahead. But it just comes to mind that we are now saying we've got some principles, and this is how, through primary financial statements, we should see the disaggregation principle working, and we should see this come through that principle without having to standard set for it. So we could argue that 16 is an ongoing issue and we're attending to something that has been on the table for quite some years. We could argue that way, but I think we had to be ready to say why we need to do this now when we've got something else coming that would, I think, would have brought that out. That was my first thing. My second matter relates to paragraph 41. Just look at what you wrote in paragraph 40. You said in A, you want to identify the sales proceeds and related production costs, and in B, provide information about the judgments involved. And then you say in paragraph 41, accordingly A and B. I think what you do in paragraph 41 is you just do 40A, right? And that's what you say in 42. And it's quite clear, but you just need to tidy that up. And it might, the tidying up might be as simple as taking out accordingly, because you're implying that in 41 that you address what came before. But so minor point, but I think you can tidy that up. My third point is relates to the issue to do with IFRS 6, so paragraph 40, well, your conclusion, really, paragraph 50. And my question is, what does this mean for people who are actually doing this? Because we're saying, and I think rightly so, that we're silent on this. You can't amend IFRS 6 for something it doesn't comment on. So I agree with the staff, with the staff's position on that. But my question is, well, where does that leave us? Does that leave us silent on the entities that are actually doing this and claiming it's within IFRS 6, that they can do it? And we know this matter relates to people in extractive industries. So I'm just wondering, so we're silent on this. Does that mean they just continue with their current practice? So diversity stays in place?
I'll maybe comment on, because we did think about that aspect in a sense. So you're absolutely right to say that our sort of main thought and argument around this is that there aren't actually any explicit requirements in IFRS 6 in this respect to amend. So it's like, if you've got nothing there, what have you got to amend? In saying, and you are right, then I think that if the board agrees with our recommendation, effectively in this amendment or via this amendment, we're not saying anything about the application of IFRS 6 and any effects this may or may not have on that. And I suppose the reason we are at least recommending and thinking that is the place to be, in a sense, is that because there isn't anything explicit or prescribed in IFRS 6, if we start to comment on it in any way, we're ending up commenting on the actual practical application of IFRS 6 for maybe this tiny piece of what is a bigger, not a bigger question on IFRS 6, but a bigger area, which is how within IFRS 6 do you measure your E&E assets at cost? IFRS 6 requires people to measure those assets at cost, but there isn't a lot of explicit detail under that. So I suppose we are recommending not saying anything about that, but more because we think, given the scope of this project, it would be sort of inappropriate or beyond the scope of this project to start to talk about how people are actually applying, you know, the wider sort of cost measurement when they're in.
So we'll live with any diversity that comes through the IFRS 6 application, because we really can't do anything about it within the constraints of this.
We just think it's beyond what we're doing in this project to start to talk about the wider application of IFRS 6.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for the paper, and I also agree with the analysis and the recommendations that come out of it. My only comment would be a wish that in the basis for conclusions we explain how we reached the conclusion that no standard setting was required, just a bit in a way as you do with an agenda decision, you know, that an entity first determines whether it's ordinary activities or not, and if it's not, would apply in 34AB in IS1, 34A in IS1, so that people don't have to look for themselves what they have to do.
Yeah, Joe.
Thank you. First of all, I agree with the staff's direction, because if we decide, actually we already decide to require those companies to recognize those sales proceeds and the cost to be included in the profits and the loss, I think the nature of those revenue and the cost or expenses is very different from other normal revenue and expenses. So separate or some kind of presentation and a disclosure requirements to help for users to understand what's the nature of those transactions. But I have two comments on it. First, whether those companies needed to separately present or disclose those sales proceeds and relevant costs really depends on those transactions, whether they are the part of an entity's ordinary activities. So it's really relying on what's the meaning of the ordinary activities. But I'm not sure whether in our standards which area we define what's, you know, the ordinary activities, and how to help preparer to decide, to make judgment, you know, whether those transactions are ordinary or not. Because I really concerned about that, because based on your paper and the previous discussion, many stakeholders, they regard those transactions are not ordinary transactions. So even we develop separate presentation disclosure requirements for those transactions are not part of the entity's ordinary, you know, activities, I'm worried about that there are some flexible room for them to make judgments. Some companies would like to disclose, and sometimes we don't want to really rely on their judgment whether those transactions are ordinary or not. Secondly, because we have PFS project, and we develop some subtotals sections based on those transactions, those activities are operating, investing, or financing. Sometimes we're also using main business activities, because it's relevant to disclose and the presentation on the statement of the performance. So people try to avoid those confusion. What's the meaning of difference of those different terms, and to help the preparer to identify in which cases they do need to disclose and to present, in which cases they do not. So I think clarify further whatever in the standard itself, or as Francois said, some in the basis of conclusion, to help the preparer to identify what's the meaning of the ordinary activities. Secondly, about the cost. Production cost. I think main concern about the, you know, cost allocation, what kind of method we should have. Paragraph 18, we make reference to the paper, agenda paper 12B for November 2018. And in that paper, there are four different kind of method for cost allocation, actually very different. So I still want to make sure, because we include it here, and then we say the cost allocation also still need to be consistent with IAS 2. So I still want to make sure whether those four different methods of cost allocation still valid or not.
No.
I think we should say no.
Yes.
Because only cost allocation allotted should be consistent with IAS 2.
Yes, exactly. And that's what.
And secondly, I think people not worry about, I think, allocation of those costs. They worry about the components of those costs, whether the production cost will include the, you know, depreciation of those PPE or not. That is the main differences. So in this case, I think this kind of information would be required disclosed separately, whether they, what kind of components of the cost they included, especially the depreciation of the PPEs, whether they included or not. Normally they were not included because the assets has not yet available for use or sale. So I think sometimes it accounts for a huge portion of the total production cost. And it's also relevant to the margin of the products you sell. So this kind of information may be useful for users.
Maybe just on the last point that you mentioned on requiring disclosure of the separate component. So we haven't specifically required that separately, but the requirements that we've identified already existing in IS2, and when it's not part of ordinary activities, the requirement that exists in IS1 would require entities to disclose their significant accounting policies that have been adopted in coming up with the production cost. So where not including depreciation would be significant, we think that would be part of the entity's accounting policy and it would be captured in that disclosure. So we don't think we need anything extra over and above that.
Also, if it's helpful, just because I know the PFS has come up twice now, and at the risk of by the way, I'm not close to the PFS project, so you will all correct me if I say anything incorrect about it. But at least what we're recommending here are just disclosure requirements. We're not suggesting anything additional or new in terms of presentation. So I suppose what we viewed this as being is much more aligned to some of the disclosure requirements, for example, that are in IAS 2 or in IFRS 15 already. It's just we're recommending it here in the situation where entities are not within the scope of IFRS 15 and IAS 2. So at least we didn't anticipate that there would be any sort of clash, in a sense, with anything happening in PFS, because what we're recommending is disclosure much more closely aligned with what's already in other standards.
And disclosures, in addition, that are consistent of irrespective of whether you assess that the proceeds arise in your ordinary activities or they do not arise in your ordinary activities. So whatever the judgment that you make in this respect, you end up by providing almost the same information in the notes of your financial statement.
I don't think it's a clash with PFS. It's just that we've now got principles under segregation, and those principles mean that we should have less specific requirements within standards.
Yeah.
Thank you. My comment may not necessarily relate to question one. Can I make a general comment, or shall I wait a little later?
Up to you, Tuck.
Later.
Very good. You also wait, François?
No, no, wait.
We're making progress with the board.
No, I wanted to make sure that I understood what Jaiwai just said. Mm. You said whether some depreciation expense is included depends on the accounting policy people will choose?
No, that's not what I was trying to say. Sorry, I was just trying to say that we don't need a separate disclosure requirement to say that entities should specify whether they've included depreciation or not, because it just goes into how they've determined their cost. Entities would apply judgment in how they determine their cost. And where they've applied judgment, we already have disclosure requirements to requiring entities to specify what judgment they've applied. And to the extent things have been included or not included that are significant to that policy, that would already be disclosed as part of the judgment disclosure. So that's why we didn't think we need anything specific in this respect.
I see what you mean, but I will react nevertheless, because rightly or wrongly, I live on the assumption that there is no depreciation cost at all, because IAS 16 is not changed from the fact that depreciation starts from the date it's available for use.
Correct.
So if that doesn't change, then there is no possibility that anybody would have to disclose. So we agree.
So I think the conversation, I think, was about whether there was specific disclosure needed or not. It would be absolutely clear, I think, given that we're talking about what's happening before this particular item of PP&E has reached the point that it started to be depreciated. I think it's clear there should be nothing in the cost that is linked to depreciation of that particular item, because it's simply not started to be depreciated. What I can't say, for example, Francois, is, and I'm just making this up now, by the way, I don't know if it's true, is if in producing those items that you sell, if maybe you use another asset that's already being depreciated.
Oh, yes.
Perhaps in theory that could be there, but that, as I say, I'm just making that up in a sense. There certainly couldn't, you know, by definition, be any depreciation of the particular item of PP&E that is being made available for use. But there may be.
I think the level of judgment, which is already required in order to determine whether you allocate a certain cost to the sale proceeds or to the testing phase, because you still have this, it's just enough. I would want to make sure that we don't confuse people with this depreciation.
Yeah. Absolutely. And that's almost what we're suggesting. We're suggesting people apply IAS 2 and we don't need to.
That's what I understood.
Yeah.
I think my comment is probably more for Neely than for the team here, because what I took away goes back to the point about interaction with PFS. I agree with Anne, there's not a conflict. But one of the things that Jane Dow raised that I made a note of is in PFS, we put a lot of reliance on what is, I think the phrase is, main business activity. And the question is, how does main business activity, which determines what's in operating, interact with ordinary activity, which is the phrase that you're relying on in this project? And I think, and it's probably in PFS, that we just need to clarify that relationship. It's not this project.
Yeah.
Ordinary activity is language that we have in the standards now, and you're using that. That makes sense.
Katrina and I were just passing notes, I think, to both of those points, with the main business activities as well as the disaggregation point. I think part of what's happening here is because this project is farther along than PFS. It sort of makes sense to finish this project as it is compared to existing standards. And then with PFS, if we need to do a consequential amendment, because we don't know where that'll end up eventually, if we need to do consequential amendments, we can always do that subsequently.
Yeah, but my point is something that we actually have to explain in the PFS document, how those two things interact.
And? Yeah, I had a similar follow-up to that Mary's expressed to John Show's comment. I don't think staff should be going at this point into trying to work out what's ordinary and not ordinary. Stay away from it. Tidy this up, and other things are going to come up in PFS.
Okay, can we vote on question?
I had a comment.
Huh? Oh, Tom.
Sorry. Right at the end, this is one of these kind of things that may be perverse, so I just want to say it. So this, we're fixing 17E, which says, as I understand, that's what we're doing, I think, cost of testing whether the asset is functioning properly after deducting the net proceeds from selling any items produced while bringing the asset. So that was, so it's in there under the cost of the fixed asset. So now we're saying take that out of the cost of the fixed asset, but we're going to say, because this was once part of the costs of the fixed asset, to look for the accounting for these costs that are no longer part, go to the fixed asset standard. Like, and I have a problem with this. This really, in some sense, it ought to just disappear out of there. Right? I mean, that's why we're leaving it in 6. We're going to put this disclosure requirement in 16. Or where is it going to go?
Yes. So in doing this amendment, you're right, Tom, that what if we look at sort of what was in the ED, we are, you know, striking through that second piece of that 17E to leave that what's part of the cost of PP&E is cost of testing, but removing that sort of net of proceeds. We are, however, also then proposing to add an explanatory paragraph, which I think we need in IS 16, that just describes what happens with those things. It's saying items may be produced, and in the case they are produced and sold, you'll recognise that in profit or loss. So I still think there is a hook, if you know what I mean, in the requirements of IS 16, because we're not just striking through 17E, we're also adding a paragraph in IS 16 to explain what you do.
Okay.
Okay, can we vote on question one?
13, one absent.
We now move on to paragraph 45 to 54, which discuss possible consequential amendments to other IFRS standards. On the basis of our analysis in paragraph 45 to 50, we recommend the board not undertake standard setting on IFRS 6. Further, based on our analysis in paragraph 51 to 54, we recommend the board not proceed with the proposed editorial amendment to IFRIC 20 that was included in the exposure draft. I will now direct your attention to question 2 on page 14 of the paper and ask whether you agree with our recommendation.
Duck. Oh, yes.
I disagree.
Final will.
I have two different type of comment. One is about specifically question 2, and the other is general one. So first, specifically to the question 2, I disagree with the staff's recommendation, because we need to make a consequential amendment. Otherwise, our constituents would confuse. The reason why I'm saying is that paragraph 2 of IFRIC 20 says, during the development phase of the mine, stripping costs are usually capitalized. So stripping costs are usually capitalized. Then we are saying that if you have any proceeds, it should not be capitalized. But in the practice, in the stripping procedure, they have a waste, and then waste may contain very small portion of ore which can be sold, and they sometimes sell it and get the proceeds. And then if we follow this new IS 16, that waste or proceeds should not be capitalized. So, of course, it is clear, even if we it might be clear even if we didn't have consequential amendment. However, we have changed IS 16, and then in the current practice, most constituents just simply following the paragraph 2 and including the proceeds of all to be capitalized. So in order to warn and your practice may change, we have to make a consequential amendment. So that's what I think.
So I think, Tak, by the way, you very nicely explained why we even proposed a consequential amendment.
Yeah.
In the exposure draft here, you exactly explained that sort of when we came along and looked at this and we said, we know it's just as usually, but wouldn't it be clearer if we just, you know, tweak that? And actually, we're not touching IFRIC 20 at all, because IFRIC 20 actually talks about production phase and this ED is about development phase. But just as a little tidy up to try and be clearer, let's consequentially amend that. I think what we saw is when we then got some comments back on it, it just reminded me again of every little tweak that we think about. Sometimes we think it's just harmless, and well, it's not even harmless, and it's done to be helpful, that it creates new questions. Mm. So I suppose all we were saying now was, having had some commentary on it, given that this project in IS-16 is kind of nothing to do with the main body of IFRIC 20, because IFRIC 20 is about production phase, not this, given that the word usually is in there, it's not just saying always capitalised. We thought it's actually not essential that we tweak that paragraph. That paragraph is not actually a central part of the consensus. So we just thought now, given the comments, maybe it was actually clearer not to touch IFRIC 20. Otherwise, we might have tried.
Probably we could explain it. Otherwise, people who do not care about our amendment, then they may continue their practice. But if we could explain, it may change your practice in the educational material or whatever, then that would be fine, even if we didn't change it. But just I wanted to raise it.
Mary?
I'm just thinking about Tak's comment and how people who are focused only on IFRIC 20 might not think about the consequence of the change we're making to IS-16. I agree with the staff proposal not to do the amendment. Maybe want to ask the staff to think about whether or not it would be worth using our favorite compromise of a footnote. In terms of just putting a footnote to IFRIC 20 to say, note that amendment, this amendment changed the accounting requirements for proceeds from testing. Just put it there. Just doesn't say anything more. And I just say think about that. As a way to flag it without making any change to IFRIC 20.
Okay. Can we vote in favor of the staff's recommendation?
13, one absent.
Okay. Well, that brings us to the end of this.
Take general comment.
Of the general
point. General point.
To this agenda, I hope I'm not obliged to make a joke. But one thing I have concern is a combination with the new proposal about IS-37. And this proposal in itself is okay. But if we think about the combination of IS-37's recent amendment and this new proposal, that may create more onerous contract. So is that what we intended or not? That is what we need to consider, because this is still underway. But on the other hand, IS-37's amendment has already nearly gone. So then we have to be careful what is the consequences. For example, I was a ballpoint maker. I'm having a new ballpoint pen, which I'm going to sell it in Harrods with £100. The incremental cost is only 20. But if you allocate the direct cost may cost £50. So in total, inventory cost is 70. And if I sell it in Harrods, then I can earn 30's margin. But during the production cost, if you created, say, 10,000 of this ballpoint pen, but not quite with the high quality, so you decided to sell it to discount store, and then with the price of something like 30. So if the incremental cost is 20 and the cash flow is 30, so in terms of cash flow-wise, you can earn 300,000 extra cash flow. So that is the good decision. However, if we combine with the recent IS-37's proposal, you have to recognize onerous contract loss as much as 400,000, because the cost of inventory is 400,000. So that could change the behavior of some of the preparer. Some preparer may think that it may be wise to scrap the byproducts which made during the testing period. So such kind of things may happen. That is what we have to be careful. And I'm not disagreeing with this one, and I agree this is the right decision. But like Jin Chao pointed out, it opens up lots of things. What is the appropriate allocation of cost? And what is the timing of the recognizing inventory? And what is the ordinary activity? And what is the performance part? So it's a small change, but it contains a significant element. That is the general comment I wanted to make.
Amaro, did you also want to make some final philosophical comments?
I thank you for the opportunity.
Did you want to answer that, or no?
Not necessarily, other than to say if it's reassuring, Tag, I think some of the comments you've made are similar to some comments that have come through in comment letters in response to the IS-37 exposure draft. So I anticipate at least some of the points you made there will be discussed by the board when we bring back papers to the board talking about that onerous contract exposure draft.
So this brings us to the end of this board meeting, which is the final board meeting of Tak, who spoke these beautiful words at the end of this meeting, and Amaru. Amaru spent 10 years with us. Tak spent 8 years with us. Those are long periods in which you contributed immensely to the discussions at this board table. You also both did quite an enormous effort to advance the cause of IFRS in your region. Amaro traveled all over Latin America many times. I spent some time with him. Tak did a lot of work from the Tokyo office, and I always love to go there with him as well. You both did a fantastic job. We are going to say properly goodbye to you later today on two occasions. I will save all my anecdotes about the more embarrassing parts of your career for then. Right now, I just want to thank you for your fantastic contribution to this board and all its office activities, and I wish you well in your future career, which I'm sure has not ended by now. Thank you.
Okay.